This is Archbishop William Laurie of Baltimore, and you are listening to Catholic Review Radio. Catholic Review Radio is a weekly radio program and podcast hosted by Catholic Review Media, the news operation of the Archdiocese of Baltimore. We are grateful to our Catholic partners for the opportunity to bring quality Catholic programming to our listeners each week.
Welcome to Catholic Review Radio. I'm George Matisek. Dante's Inferno, the first part of the Divine Comedy, is often called one of the greatest poems ever written. The epic journey through hell explores the nature of sin and virtue in a way that still speaks to us today. Even Pope Francis has encouraged Catholics to read the Divine Comedy. Today, we're joined by Jason M. Baxter to discuss why Dante's work still matters and what it has to say to modern readers. Jason is a professor and the executive director of the Center for Beauty and Culture at Benedictine College in Kansas. A convert to Catholicism, he's the author of a new English translation of Inferno, published by Angelico Press. Jason, thanks for being on the show.
So glad to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
Jason, the Divine Comedy has been around since the 14th century, and it strikes me that it's one of those works that kind of sits on the top shelf in people's homes, and it kind of gathers dust, but people don't take it down and read it. And I wonder, when was the first time that you read the Divine Comedy, and what was that experience like for you?
Yeah, it was a disaster. I was 18, and I was at this amazing, wonderful kind of year-long introduction to the Great Books Program in Ottawa, Canada. And I was so excited to be there. So I was a motivated kid. But I started reading this thing, and I thought, what? I couldn't get any of the references. I couldn't get a clear idea of the structure. So my first time with a comedy was kind of a disaster. And the second time I went through it when I was at University of Dallas and, you know, taking their core curriculum, I didn't like it then either. But I liked one or two moments, and I thought, okay, one or two moments, I get it. And for me, it wasn't until, I think, you know, reading it the third time that I began to realize, oh, that's what's happening. So I think a lot of my teaching at Benedictine College, but also other places, a lot of my writing has been focused on younger versions of myself, right? Because how easy would it have been for me to, you know, say, oh, I read it. I guess, you know, it wasn't my thing, and then never go back to it. And I think I would have sort of deprived myself of all this kind of spiritual nourishment in the text. So yeah, I think I always have an eye out for those readers. Like, wait a minute. You're going to like this more than you thought.
What makes it so challenging? It was written in medieval days, and obviously it's a very lengthy work, but what makes it so challenging?
I think it's, well, I mean, you know, just like any book that has a massive number of characters, right? Can you imagine your favorite, you know, television series over the course of a season introducing 700 characters? I mean, there's something like 300 speaking characters within the whole of the comedy, and at least another 300 or 400 others mentioned. So this is a huge range. So you really got to be up on your mythology. You really got to be up on your classical Greek and Roman history. And then I think what was definitely the most difficult for us are his contemporary references, right? I mean, so they're all, and also on top of that, he likes to use these kind of learned circumlocutions, right? That he thinks it's kind of fun to have these little riddles in which all of a sudden we, you know, the illumination moment pops. And so some of these circumlocutions are impossible for us to recognize now, just because we're not living and breathing in his day. I mean, so for example, if I said, you know, the man who wasn't from America but traveled to space and wanted to make our country efficient again, like, everyone knows exactly who I'm talking about, right? But 600 years from now, you know, whether or not Musk is going to be remembered, he might just be a sort of figure who mattered in a couple of decades. So there are at least, you know, 50, 60, 70 characters like that, that everyone in Dante's world would have known exactly who this person was and sort of, you know, caught the recognition. So those are some of the tricky things that get in our way of appreciating the deep structure.
I think you did a great job in the introduction to your book, where you give a great description of the world in which Dante was living. It was a very corrupt world. Like, could you describe for our listeners what that was like? What was the milieu in which Dante wrote?
Yeah, I mean, the ideal way to read Dante's Inferno is to go back into 2024 and read this thing in September or October of election season. And then you'll have as much anxiety and divisiveness and like worry about the future as Dante had in his own age. But yeah, no, it is. It's a very divisive world. There's sort of these like, deep kind of tectonic plates of sort of grinding against each other for a couple of centuries. But in essence, the papacy had allied itself with a series of kind of wealthy city-states against the older aristocratic culture, which was in alignment with the Roman emperors, or at least the newest batch of Roman emperors who were German. And these German Roman emperors, the Holy Roman Empire, are ready to come back and reclaim the actual rule over the Italian peninsula. And so they had begun to sort of creep back in with a dynasty in the 13th century, and thus sort of all of Dante's world, all even sort of city by city, was divided between these so-called Guelphs and Ghibellines, right? These papal supporters versus imperial supporters, and this kind of fractiousness got down even into the sort of the levels of the even to the levels of an individual city. So as I jokingly put it in my book, with a shout out to Benedictine College, right? Look, in our world, if you want to run for office of dog catcher in Atchison, Kansas, you'll have to do so as a Democrat or a Republican. And so all the sort of usual, the usual sort of divisiveness and difficulty of being a human gets sort of mapped onto these big kind of international politics. And on top of that, Dante seemingly read a bunch of kind of Franciscan, the spiritual Franciscans. And so he had a little bit of an apocalyptic mentality. He sort of thought that, he was right on the verge of the sixth and the seventh age. Right, in which the church would actually be cleansed of its vices. And having been so corrupt in his day, that doesn't sound familiar, does it? And that it would go through a period of it would go through a period of renewal and purity, in which individual priests and cardinals and archbishops and so forth would be more like the Franciscans and the Dominicans, the mendicant orders, than they had been previously. But the spiritual Franciscans thought there would be one last attack from the Antichrist, and all of the individual temptations he had used over the five previous ages would be dumped on the world in the great sixth age, and it would be this kind of epic spiritual battle. That's the sort of world that Dante thought that felt that he belonged to. And believe it or not, Dante thought that if he wrote this poem, he could, as he says in the Paradiso, he says, "Poca favilla, gran fiamma seconda." Sometimes a great flame follows from a tiny spark. He thought that his poem could be like this spark that could actually give people a taste for heavenly things, which became so consuming in their hearts that his world could actually be transformed. And so I suppose he was partly right and partly wrong, right? We still live in a world which is, decidedly similar to the world that he describes in terms of divisiveness and vice and anxiety. And yet, 700 years on, we have this handful of people who are inspired by it every single generation, and have come to feel that it's urgent, and not just a classic, but it's got something to say to us in particular.
What do you think it says to the modern reader, especially in this secular world we live in, where so often there's no thought about the eternal consequences of sin?
Oh, that's great. What a cool question. I say that one of the most modern things about Dante's Inferno is that it feels, the characters feel to be on the periphery of their beings. They feel to be distracting themselves from this deeper wound, right? We know that this wound, and at some point, you could even in this life, you could even say it's a good wound, right? It's the whispering of the divine, right? This hunger for something which is goes deeper than any income or successful job or house or arrangement or title or whatever can give me, right? In fact, it's weird that sometimes the most successful people in this world are also have this secret ache of discontent, right? This wound that is not enough, right? If this is the medieval tradition Confession just talks about this wound as the beckoning call of the divine, of the supernatural. Well, if that's the human condition, is to feel this this aching call, this whispering voice, what's so interesting about the Inferno is that it seems that Dante's characters in hell are doing everything they can to lean into their punishment, to talk about old wounds. They're doing everything they can to distract themselves. They're engaged in self-distraction, what I call living on the periphery of their being, right? Or a kind of like bottomless scrolling with their thoughts. They don't want to deal with the wound. They don't want to deal with the betrayal that they've made. And thus, I think that, and this is something that it's not just me, but, you know, T.S. Eliot and Ezra Pound and some of these modernist poets, Samuel Beckett, they all felt that Dante's Inferno was weirdly modern, that it could have described, you know, 20th century society, in which we, of course, that's gone into, that's gone into, you know, to hyperdrive, right? Our distraction by distraction from distraction, Eliot puts it in the Four Quartets. I think that when people read that and realize that Dante has this kind of psychological depth, and thus the ability to portray characters who we get to know better than they know themselves, is eerily modern.
Our guest today is Jason M. Baxter. He's the author of a new English translation of Dante's Inferno, published by Angelico Press. And we're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we'll continue our conversation and we'll ask Jason specifically how he went about translating this work. I'm George Matisek. You're listening to Catholic Review Radio. We'll be back in a moment.
Where can a Master of Theological Studies take you? At Loyola University, Maryland, our program prepares you for careers with nonprofits, religious ed, campus ministry, law, social work, and higher ed. Choose from three specialized tracks or our certificate in theology and ministry. Experience small classes, mentoring, networking opportunities, and more. Apply by August 1st for this fall. Learn more at loyola.edu/theology.
With inviting surroundings, complete independence, and an unmatched quality of life, Mercy Ridge is the unparalleled choice for your retirement lifestyle. It's a way of living that promotes an active, healthier life. Located in Timonium, Maryland, Mercy Ridge Continuing Care Retirement Community features a beautifully landscaped 32-acre campus. The grounds, dining, and recreational amenities and residences are designed to provide a gracious lifestyle and a variety of exciting activities. Visit mercyridge.com.
This is Archbishop William Laurie of Baltimore, and you are listening to Catholic Review Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Review Radio. I'm George Matisek. Our guest today is Jason M. Baxter. He's a professor and the executive director of the Center for Beauty and Culture at Benedictine College in Kansas, and he's also the author of a new English translation of Dante's Inferno. Jason, Dante wrote this work in Italian and not in Latin, which would have been considered a really revolutionary thing to do at that time. What made writing in the vernacular such a bold move for Dante?
Yeah, I mean, you could say that he should have written it in Italian, in Latin, right? He should have, quote unquote. Because in Dante's day, the expectation was that works of learning, that works of depth, you could say, works of medicine, works of law, works of theology, works of philosophy, or the learned poems that were trying to engage in these highest subjects should have been written in Latin. In fact, in Dante's day, they weren't even entirely sure that that Italian had a grammar. And I think it felt to them like maybe, you know, some urban dialect might feel like to us, like, well, I mean, that's fine for, you know, talking to your friends and your buddies, or just like some whatever sort of local dialect, right? You know, that's fine for talking to mom or your buddies or something like that. But, you know, if you're going to give a lecture in a lecture hall, you have to revert back to this kind of standard English, right? That's sort of, you know, kind of our expectation as well. So when Dante did that, it did come as a surprise, and even got some criticism in his day from learned people. But I think that What's exciting is that Dante, first of all, he oftentimes takes his Italian and he tries to clean it up in a little bit. He had given himself this written all these rules for himself, what I jokingly called with my students at Benedictine College, Dante's diary. And that he had given himself certain words that you can say and certain words that you can't say. And he'd gone down to the individual level of the syllable. Say, yep, words like amore, dona, desio, virtute, sorpresa, gentile, those are good words. He says they leave your mouth clean and leave an aftertaste of sweetness, right? Use those. And then he gave himself a list of all kinds of what he thought were ugly words, words with double Z's and double X's and double ch sounds, right? And he had spent the first part of his life trying to write this perfect poem, which was, you know, soaring and lyrical and down perfect down to the syllable. But by the time he gets to the Inferno, he starts to use all of those things that he told himself that he wouldn't use when he was trying to write these early lyric poems. So something extraordinary happened. It's a really exciting story. It's not something we know 100%. But what I speculate is that two things happened. One, that he began to realize that his world had become so evil that it wouldn't sit still, that it would fidget even in the presence of beauty and that you could pass out your poem and people would get bored by it, right? And they wouldn't actually be able to hear it. So what he needed to do was use something which was sharp and grating enough to force people to pay attention and then to get to that type of interiority, right? And I think the other reason that he did it was he realized that his poem was meant to be a quest for God, as I jokingly put it, from caterpillars to supernovas, from the lowest things in the universe to the highest things in the universe. And to create this kind of huge poetic verbal icon, he needed to go imagine like an organ. He needed to go all the way down to the lowest notes to get all the way up to the highest notes. And he needed this complete representation. So I think this was the sort of breakthrough moment for Dante in which he realized that he could outclassic the classics if he gave himself this wide palette of emotional expressivity. He could get things for the head, for the heart, but also for the body. And he could create this deeper and broader and higher icon of the universe. And that's, I suspect that's part of the reason why we're still reading it.
So how do you translate that into English? It's so complex and so nuanced. And you're also trying to get a sense of the rhythm. So how do you go about that?
Well, I mean, first of all, it's absolutely exhausting. And I think my wife is going to be really excited when I finish the project. I'm working on Purgatorio right now, and then eventually Paradiso will do that. And it's just been absolutely psychologically fatiguing, I think probably in the best way. But what my translation tries to do is that, first of all, so I don't bother with rhyme. There are some older translations that do try to achieve the rhyme. However, I do want some rhythm. So it is written in meter. It's not written in iambic pentameter per se, but it is written iambically. And I have these sliding lines so that everyone feels and sounds musical. That's important because that music is on the surface of Dante's poem. But in the meantime, I think what I'm excited about this poem, and I think this is what's getting its readers, this translation is getting the readers so excited, is that I use moments in which, I guess, you know, in music you would call them staccato moments, in which I have some one-line sentences and I have some registers in which it drops low. And rather than not just talking like a classic ought to, or a college professor with elbow patches, you know, would talk to you in his classroom, right? But all of a sudden, Dante gets into the nitty-gritty of the world. He talks about crafts, and he talks about blood, and he talks about mud, and he talks about rocks. And he uses language which sort of doesn't just get into your head, but it gets into your body, right? It gets into your pulse, into your veins. So my translation tries to do something like that. It has some of these owlic, floating, soaring, lyrical moments, which Dante's very good at those, but it also has these rhythmical, pulsing moments in which Dante sort of drops this register just to make sure that you're paying attention.
What's your favorite line from the work? You probably have a million of them, but if you had to single out a single line from Dante's Inferno, what would it be?
That's great. I mean, my students love to catch me out because I say, "Oh, this is my favorite canto," and then they'll wait. I'll wait a week or two. I'm like, "Oh, here's my favorite canto," and eventually, in the sixth or seventh time I've said that, they'll say, "Wait a minute, we've heard you say that before." But I think our listeners will probably can get the best idea the quickest if they're gonna love this new translation by going to Inferno 9. Okay. That's the scene where Virgil's knocking on the gates. He needs to take Dante into so-called deep hell. But their journey has stalled out because in the Aeneid, Aeneas wasn't allowed to go into these deep things. Now, the Christian poet needs to go inside and he needs to go all the way down and he has to go to the center of the universe and the center of the heart. And it's precisely at this moment that Dante brings this wonderful cataclysmic windstorm of an angel, which sort of comes roiling over the swamp of hell. And you can see Dante's full linguistic power on display there. So I think that was me at my best as a translator. And it's definitely my favorite canto from Inferno 9.
How long did it take you to translate this work?
In some ways, you could tell it took me 40 years, right? I feel like I had to use every single resource and every bit of learning I'd ever achieved. And, I was a classics major at University of Dallas as an undergraduate. And I think, having had some experience with Latin back in the day was also necessary. But Inferno, off and on, took me about 6 years to do, and then a year and a half of just like incredible intensity. So I'd sort of got it started. But I didn't yet know what I was going to do. I didn't yet have a feel for it. I had it sort of correct, in the kind of line by line, but I hadn't got my vision of this kind of this heartbeat and this pulse and this bodily aspect that later kind of helped me go back to that and translate it. And I think just took it from kind of an academic exercise of exactitude to kind of a spiritual exercise of something that you could feel in the veins and in the pulse and in the heart.
Has digging into the Inferno had any impact on your faith?
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's hard to separate that, to isolate that from all the other things that one does in one's faith life, but I do think so. I think. I don't know. I've always had a reverence and a love for old things and an appreciation for the thought of our ancestors. But I don't know. It feels kind of strange, but I almost feel like I have a friendship with Dante now. That I don't just admire him and with my brain, I love him, right? Like, I want to give him a hug, like I would give my dad a hug. But I think that's exactly part of the point, right? Is that for Dante's sort of breakthrough as a lyric poet is that. Is that Christianity is not ultimately an affair of the brain. I mean, we can catch ourselves out doing this. If you ask someone, are you Catholic or are you Christian? They'll say yes or no. But oftentimes, what they mean is what we mean when we ask that is, do you hold the 17 necessary correct opinions which would qualify you for this? So for us, we sometimes slip into this idea that the faith is. A philosophical system or a creed. And I think Dante sort of helps with that of, reminding us, well, this is, of course, there are doctrinal and dogmatic principles, but this is a lived reality in which we're responding to a supernatural calling. And I think that's the way that Dante sort of helped in that way is kind of protecting, well, I'm a professor, right, at Benedictine College. Protecting me from thinking that Christianity and Jesus Christ is a mere kind of, like system of correct axioms and proofs and deductions, but it's a lived reality.
What advice would you have for the layman who wants to read this work? Should you read it straight through? Do you start at a certain chapter? Do you read certain passages? What would be your advice?
Yes. Yeah, I think it's best to do it. It's best to do it in a company of other people if you can do it, and it's best to do it out loud. And so I would say I've also written a beginner's guide to Dante's comedy, which and so I've recommended to folks in the past, look, hey, you could read like a chapter of that and then get your buddies together and then read it aloud, preferably with wine, right? And you could read it aloud and just go sort of canto. It takes about 7 minutes to read a single canto, one of these individual chapters. But if you've read, you know, the beginner's guide and kind of figured out some of those names behind it, then it could be a really enjoyable experience, because then you're starting to talk about what's really exciting in Dante, not just the what, but the how. And that's, and I think that's when the poem will sort of start opening up to people.
And how can people get a copy of your book?
It's available on Angelico, the press's website. That's the publisher, Angelico Press's website. It's also available on Amazon, of course, but it's also available through jasonmbaxter.com, which is my website, jasonmbaxter.com. And if your listeners are interested, they can buy a copy. I'll sign it. And I'll pack it with my random lecture notes of whatever happens to be on my desktop table. People just think that's amazing. Apparently, Amazon doesn't do that.
That's great. Well, our guest today has been Jason M. Baxter. He is a professor and the executive director of the Center for Beauty and Culture at Benedictine College in Kansas. And he's the author of a new English translation of Inferno, published by Angelico Press. So, Jason, thanks again so much for being here on Catholic Review Radio.
Thanks, George. Really appreciate it.
For Catholic Review Radio, I'm George Matusek. Thanks for listening.
The Catholic Review is the only publication in the Archdiocese of Baltimore that covers the Catholic Church full-time. Pick up the monthly magazine at your parish or have it delivered to your home. Subscribe to our e-newsletter for twice-weekly updates. Just text CR Media to 84576. Follow the Catholic Review on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. Read it today in print or online at CatholicReview.org. That's CatholicReview.org.
Tune in to Catholic Review Radio next week. Available on WMET 1160 AM and 103.1 FM. Also, WSJF 92.7 FM in the Sykesville area and WVTO 92.7 FM in Baltimore City. Check us out on SoundCloud or your favorite podcast app.
Thank you for joining us for this edition of Catholic Review Radio. As we prepare for the week ahead, let us do so in prayer together as one community of faith. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Let us also ask the blessing and intercession of our Blessed Mother as we pray, Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou among women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners now and at the hour of our death. Amen. May Almighty God bless us and keep us always in his love.